Hello, and welcome back to Owen's Variety Hour. You know what? When I was starting this show, I'll be honest, I was running a bit late, and I knew that Bare Naked Ladies were on, and I would have loved to just start right with that. But sadly, I was running a bit over. You know what? I had to play a different song in between. But optimally, every show should start with the Bare Naked Ladies. That is always how I imagined this show. And I think that's just the duty of service that I owe to you, my audience. But anyway, welcome to the second episode of the show. And unfortunately, you know what? I've already sort of ran out of every idea that I had for this show. And I don't really know how this one's gonna go. Maybe I should try to become like a more general radio show, like appealing to each and every demographic I can think of. So, yeah, I don't know. Let's try that. So the weather, it's not great. Slipped on the way here. Pretty cold, eh? Oh. Anything good on TV? Nah, yeah, I figured. Sports. The Super Bowl's coming up. That's exciting. Some food and stuff. I'll cut this out anyway. So, but last night, you know, saw the Canadian artist Danny Michel at the Jazz Room in Uptown Waterloo, and this is just a short story. There was a guy sitting there in his chair, and he was leaning back quite far. Far enough that I'd expect him to fall. I was actually sort of impressed that he hadn't. And then a waitress came over to him and told him that, and I imagine she was telling him to sit back down because that's what I would do if I was a waitress there. And then he did sit back down. So I was like, oh, good. And then like a minute later, he was leaning back up again. So I realized it must have been for something else. But then I thought about it a bit more and I realized that I actually did hope that she had told him to sit down. But this guy just could not be bothered by what other people think about him and his posture and his leaning. So he just did it like a cool guy. So that's how this show's gonna go, sort of things like that. But I think we have a pretty good show plan. Got a few things to talk about. Probably not as many things as last week, but probably longer this time. Longer for each things. We'll see. Now I'm gonna talk about some new singles that came out, a new movie, and I'm gonna end up talking a lot about the filmmaker Harmony Korine, and then I'm going to tell an uncharacteristically sad tale. And, you know, after last week's episode, the paparazzi started swarming over and they were rewarding me for all my accomplishments in comedy that I got after just one episode. And you know what? I was blown away. I'm no comedian. I'm just a storyteller, sharing narratives to enlighten the human spirit, the soul, expressing the true themes of the universe. I'm no comedian. And, you know, that is why I thought I'd change it up a bit, bring some more depth to my role as a host, as a storyteller, as a human, and maybe more to your role as participant, as the audience. But however, that will begin after the break, with her first song being Joanna Newsom with Bridges and Balloons from her debut album, Milk-Eyed Mender. Please enjoy. Hey guys, you know what? I'll admit it. I lied to you earlier. I told you I was going to start getting dramatic, and that was just so you guys would stay through the song, you know what? I really wanted you guys to hear it, and that'll come later. But now it's time for the New Discoveries column. If you recall last week, this is when I pretty much just talk about things that I've discovered recently, ran into, for your benefit. So maybe you can try some stuff out that I like. Who knows? That sounds really egotistic. Now that it's coming out of my mouth, but whatever. It's my show. The first thing I want to talk about is Murmurs by Agnes Varda. And the title translates to Wall Walls, which isn't exactly a pun that makes any sense in the English language. But in French, it sort of sounds like Murmurs, so it's kind of funny. Agnes Varda was one of the key figures in the French New Wave scene from the 60s. Having made particularly the film Cleo from 5 to 7 in 62. And this was one of the movies that Agnes made during her stay in Los Angeles in the 80s. I believe it came out in 81. And it sort of explores the beauty and the endless potential that public art can have through showing the mural art all around the city. And she also goes into and explores the varying art styles and has the artists explain some of the symbolism and the meaning to some of these beautiful works of art that are just all around the city for everyone to see. And I can't help but, as a viewer of this in 2019, to compare it with something sort of like Banksy, the street artist who sort of puts up pieces and then they get sold and the walls are removed and they're put in rich people's houses. And like, it's like all this art is so political and it's anti-capitalist, but then it ends up being used just as a capitalist device. It's sold for a ton of money and then it's just shown off as a status symbol. And even when he does end up making something that's like a protest, such as the shredding art piece recently, it works for 1 second that everyone's shocked at them spending money for this, but then they end up spending even more money because of the controversy and the statements that it's making. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem truly effective in the public as some of the artwork that Agnes Varda is showing, where it truly is just out there for the people to see. And these works are either all commissioned by the people who own those buildings or by the city or whatever. And the whole purpose is just for people to see it and for this art to be in people's everyday lives. But anyway, this seems like an important precursor to to Agnes Varda's more recent film, Faces Places, in which she goes around with this artist and makes these big murals on walls to sort of celebrate the people in those towns, which I also think is a recommended watch, as well as Murmurs. And it's just like from these movies, you can tell that Agnes Varda has so much empathy for what these artists are creating and so much passion for the art itself. It's truly wonderful and definitely recommended. One of the singles I want to talk about is the new Vampire Weekend, the double single of Harmony Hall and 2021. And this is obviously a fresh sound for the band since their main producer and instrumentalist Rostam left. And it's a good thing that they aren't trying for the same production sounds that Rostam used to do, because I don't think they would have pulled it off as well. And it's just good always to take things in a new direction. And this song sort of starts pretty mellow, but ends up being so fun, and it's really just a lot of genuine emotion. And I've always thought that a lot of Vampire Weekend's material, as much as I am a fan, is sort of tongue-in-cheek, it's very aestheticized. But now it seems more like they just aren't afraid to make a fun pop song. And it's just great songwriting in general from Ezra Koenig. And there's an interpolation from their song Fingerback from their last album, which works particularly well. The other single that came with Harmony Hall is 2021, which seems more like a short interlude, so there isn't really too much to say. But the instrumentation is very nice, and Ezra has some nice little hums in it. And there's this boy sample that keeps playing through it, which I believe was recorded by Jenny Lewis. And as much as there was sort of some confusion when they announced that the album was going to be 18 songs long. And it's nice to know that if there are some sort of smaller songs like this in it, and they are capable of writing just these small little fun songs, it sort of gives a little bit of hope for the whole project. And so these songs are in support of the new album, Father of the Bride, I think there are singles coming every month. So most likely I'll keep on covering them in these segments. I've been a fan of most of Vampire Weekend stuff so far, and I hope it continues. The next song I want to talk about is Florence and the Machine's Moderation. And as opposed to Vampire Weekend, who this is their first songs in 5 or 6 years or so, Florence and the Machine's new song is following last year's album High as Hope, which I thought was a very emotional and mature album. As much as some of the tracks didn't really land for me, there's some great tracks there, including the single Big God, and as the new single is, it's very organic, very soulful, and Florence just sounds really strong on the song. She just sounds like a great vocalist, and she sounds so mature and lovely and so powerful, too. It's really great, and the song's fantastic. The movie I want to talk about in this segment is the new film from Barry Jenkins, If Beale Street Could Talk, which is based on the 1974 book by James Baldwin, which I have read and loved. And I'd have to say that the adaptation definitely lives up to it. And Barry has just such a strong sense of style and emotion that he really captured the true love and tragedy between the characters in the book so well, which makes it simultaneously one of the most heartfelt and heartbreaking movies I've seen recently, which makes it also just one of the best movies from last year, in my opinion. And I'm not going to talk too much about this because I do really think that it should speak for itself, as it is currently playing at the Princess Original in Waterloo, I believe, until Sunday. So you should go check it out. It's a great movie, and it'll really tug on those old heartstrings. So now, I'm going to play that Vampire Weekend song I was talking about. This is Harmony Hall. I'm going to be honest, I've had that song stuck in my head for about a week or so since it came out. It's just so catchy. Actually, I say it corrected, it's only been out for 5 days, but it's felt like a week that it's been stuck in my head. And for this review segment that we're going to go into now, I was thinking that I'm going to maybe start doing more like artist retrospectives or like catch-ups. And sort of this is an idea I like and might continue with occasionally, where I just talk about an artist and their work as a collective, where I sort of build through and see how they change, how things are similar or interact with each other, rather than just one work like I did last week with A Moment of Innocence. And the first of these types, I will be discussing the American weirdo filmmaker Harmony Korine. So, Harmony Korine, from his name, you can tell that his parents were sort of hippies, that he spent some time living in a commune, and his father was a documentary filmmaker for PBS who had traveled to carnivals and fairs documenting different people's ways of life. And then when he grew up, he went to New York to study filmmaking, but eventually dropped out to be a skateboarder. And this is where he met the filmmaker Larry Clark, who got Harmony to write the movie Kids, which explored the lives of New York City teens, and then explored their sort of relationships with sex, drugs, and how this all sort of relates to the AIDS epidemic at the time. And the movie is pretty shocking and was controversial at the time, and it was deemed to be borderline child pornography. But since, the film has grown quite a cult following, as Korine as a filmmaker has as well, and this was just our first exposure to his shocking style of social commentary as he focused on how the modern world had affected youth at that time. And the film is particularly impactful, I think, because Harmony was only 19 when he wrote the screenplay, and it's about a subculture that he is a part of. So it's not like it's really that like exploitative or incorrect, because he was there. He was living amongst the people that he was writing about. And then to continue through his filmography, it's easy to tell how his dad's history and culture documentaries influenced Harmony's films, which is particularly prevalent in Gummo, which was his first directorial feature length, which focused on a group of people living in a poor town in Ohio after a tornado strikes. And it uses this as a setting to sort of show the culture of these people in a uniquely empathetic way, as for most of the time, their lives seem shocking and almost disgusting. But really, they're just living their lives. This is what they're used to, and they aren't really complaining about their situation. It isn't glamorizing or romanticizing their poverty or anything like that. It isn't even looking for sympathy for these characters. It's just showing them as people just living their lives. And I'm going to be honest, I find this to be a particularly hard film to talk about. There's so much to unpack, and some of the times it can be quite contradicting or confusing in some of its themes. And that sort of element of contradictions sort of set the stage for the rest of Harmony's career. His next film being Julian Donkey Boy, which was created under the Dogme 95 manifesto of Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg, as sort of a purist way of making films, or as they put it, of the vows of chastity. And the film stars Ewan Bremner as the titular Julian, who was known for his character as of Spud in the movie Trainspotting, as well as Chloe Sevigny, who appeared in Kids and Gummo. She was actually dating Harmony at the time. And the movie also has a nice appearance from the German filmmaker Werner Herzog, who plays Ewan and Chloe's father. And the film sort of just shows this dysfunctional family, as the main character, Julian, has schizophrenia, and the father is abusive and doesn't seem to care about any of them. But this is all shown without really a clear plot, but rather vignettes about the family's lives and different things that are going on. And the film has a particularly lo-fi and experimental aesthetic, which Harmony made from filming it on one type of film and then transferring it to a different type of film and then blowing it up to a different type of film. So pretty much anything of professional quality was lost somewhere in between. And I think this aesthetic could be very off-putting as it's pretty hard to watch, but it's used in this way that enhances and seems to fit the whole mood of this movie. And the next movie, Mr. Lonely, Harmony is working with his biggest budget yet, and it shows, surprisingly. It almost feels like a normally professionally made movie, and it tells the story of a Michael Jackson impersonator, so you can tell it isn't quite a normal movie, but still, it looks like one. So, Michael Jackson, we see him dancing for change in the street in France. He doesn't seem too successful. We see him visiting old folks' homes and giving inspirational speeches about how they're never gonna die. And we never really see him as anything except for a Michael Jackson impersonator. He's actually credited as Michael Jackson in the movie, which adds the sort of defining layer to this movie. As we're seeing how he's living as Michael. His real personality, his actual person, isn't actually present as people don't seem to be interested. They're only interested in this impression that he's doing all the time. And this is where we meet Marilyn Monroe, a different impersonator who is fascinated by Michael and invites him to live in their commune out in Scotland with a group of celebrity impersonators. And there we see how dedicated all these people are to their craft and the characters that they have created. And besides some dramatic storylines that happen in the commune, I don't find that much really happens that was too remarkable or interesting in terms of character building or great insights. There are some funny or interesting scenes here and there, but overall it seems a bit underwhelming. But as Corinne has showed before, he presents these characters with a lot of heart and empathy for what they're doing. And their sort of delusion that they've put into becoming these characters is shown more as a pure dedication rather than anything that we should be making fun of them for. And I think my favorite part of this movie is that there's a different story that has a few scenes that's sort of shown in between parts of the main impersonator storyline that involves Werner Herzog as a priest with a convent of nuns. And they have a mission to deliver food to a village from an airplane, and suddenly one of the nuns falls out of the airplane, and her descent to the ground is sort of shot like this cool skydiving action movie, and it's just so absurd and honestly shockingly hilarious. And I had to sort of check if I was laughing for the wrong reasons at a nun falling to her death, but then she hits the ground and lives. And it becomes a bizarre testament to the protection of God over his most devoted subjects. And it's so funny from that point on. Like, it's really crazy and creatively just hilarious how much. And then we see all the nuns jumping out of airplanes and they're all living because they're purely religious and God is truly looking over them. It's not just some sort of delusion they're having. It's pure. And I'm going to be honest, I don't quite get how this ties into the impersonator storylines, but I don't really mind. It was my favorite part of the movie, and honestly, if this was held on its own, it would probably be one of my favorite Harmony Korine movies. But besides from that, the directing style and the camera work isn't exceptional at any point. It seems pretty basic and almost like a normal Hollywood-produced movie. And this is odd for Corinne because he had already made a pretty signature aesthetic for himself in his earlier two films with the sort of lo-fi thing and then showing this depravity. And if I was actually a fan at this time, I'd imagine that I'd be almost giving up on him and his art house origins. But then after this, he made Trash Humpers. And Trash Humpers, I actually only saw it for my first time yesterday. And essentially, it's just very grainy camcorder footage of these odd old people running around, smashing things, just being weird. And this movie plays no tricks right from the start. Everything they're doing is degrading, shocking, and disgusting. it really lives up to its name. They certainly do hump trash in a variety of different ways. And nothing seems to be related to each other. And it builds into the style that we sort of get to realize that it's shown as to be almost a collection of home videos. It seems like this is just the stuff that these people do, and they happen to film it some of the time. There isn't a plot. Characters come in and out without any real explanation, as they would in home movies. You wouldn't explain, like, oh, this is Jim, and then introduce him to the camera. No, Jim would just show up. So other characters maybe come in, get murdered, and then just it just keeps going on. So maybe it's not a relatable home movie, but it's still. And then characters keep on addressing the cameraman as if they're one of their friends who is present with them, and they're just filming. They're just like, hey, come on, film this. And it isn't this weird self-reflexivity that they're attending to break the fourth wall and actually address the audience. But it goes down the sort of found footage route as a home movie that wasn't filmed to be shown as a film, but was just made for their benefit. So catch this on film. And as well, there are some of the camcorder controls that are shown on the screen, like when you're fast-forwarding or rewinding, that is being shown, and it's just pretty funny. It's just not professional at all. And honestly, the movie is often pretty funny. There's some scenes where they're jumping on a trampoline in the middle of the street. There's these old men that are doing surprisingly good drum solos for their age. And there's this great scene where they're dragging around these old creepy dolls behind their bicycles and laughing horrifically. And it almost seems like a more gross and ingenuous version of the intro to Napoleon Dynamite when he throws the action figure out the window and drags it behind him. But besides that, I feel like there's a chance that people, including me, might look a bit too far into this movie and maybe excusing that it's pretty much just pure shock and maybe thinking that it's something a bit more deep because it's coming from this semi-established filmmaker who'd already proven himself in the indie scene. So you start to question yourself while you're watching. It's like, am I actually watching something deep and artistic? Or am I just watching old men hump trash and pee all over the place in terrible camcorder footage? I could be making this. And then it isn't until close to the movie when the movie really starts to open up when in its messaging. As there's this scene where one of the old men is driving and then just goes on a speech about how he feels bad for everyone around him. They're driving through the suburbs, and he's talking about everyone that he's driving past, just regular people. He talks about how boring their lives seem, doing their day-to-day jobs, going to church, not really having fun, well, at least not having fun the way that they are. And this is opposed to them. They are having fun. They are truly liberated. They are free to do whatever they want. And they've been showing that they will literally do anything they want. But it's a super weird emotion that it brings you into. Their lives are violent. They're disgusting. They're awful. But then we notice that they're liberated. And they're having the times of their lives. And you start to feel, am I jealous of these people? But then you think they killed people. They're not good people. But then it's like, why is Harmony attempting to show literal murderers as these liberated folks just at the end of the movie? I don't know. It's truly bizarre, and it's contradicting in any way that a Hollywood movie would be. And ultimately, this is just a hard movie and weird movie to review. I'm most likely not going to watch it again because it's disgusting. But I'm glad that I did. And I don't think many people besides Harmony Korine would be willing to make a movie like this because its plot and its message is so out there. It seems like such a risk to make something so gross, so uncommercial, with just this sort of weird, contradicting message. But it's really strangely effective. I'm glad I watched it, and I'm glad that it was made, but I don't know. I don't think I'll be seeing it again. And then, from Harmony Korine comes what some consider his opus, his magnum opus, Spring Breakers. And right from the ad campaigns for the movie, you could tell that this was going to be Harmony's biggest movie yet, by far. As it is starring none other than Disney stars Selena Gomez and Vanessa Hudgens in this sexy movie about spring break wildness with a crazy-looking riffraff. I mean, James Franco. And this was around the time when ex-Disneyers like Miley Cyrus were starting to act a bit more crazy. So it sort of fell into that type of movie for the female leads. And it also features Ashley Benson from Pretty Little Liars and Rachel Corrine, Harmony's wife, who actually starred in Trash Humpers. And this was in 2012. It was a year that gave us films like Project X. And my early high school self, and I'm sure countless others, thought this was just going to be one of those crazy movies that are meant only to be sort of provocative and emulate the otherworldly parties that we were missing, mixed with some wild actions. And that's all it was to me at the time. It was just sort of a joke that, oh, these Disney actors have really fallen off. They're making a movie about spring break. Crazy. And besides that, I had no real memories of this movie, besides this sort of image that it had created, until I got into university and I started watching Harmony Korine's other art house movies, and I had that, hold up, was that actually a cool movie moment? And I was assured it definitely was. This is still one of my favorite movies to talk about, as many other people my age had the same memories that I had about it. And it's not really ironic at all. It's just really good. And upon watching it recently to prepare for this show, I just found myself taking notes throughout and just like trying to visualize the different moods and stances that this movie is taking as a way to discuss it. And I'm not going to try and talk about every plot point in the movie, but I'll just cut it back a bit to reduce spoilers. So it starts with Skrillex's great, great song, Scary Monsters and Nice Sprites, and is giving us just what the ads promised. There are topless girls, partying, drinking, and lots of fun. And then this is just sort of showing that spring break is already happening. And then we're introduced to the characters. And Selena Gomez's character is a church girl. And then, yeah, it sort of makes more sense that she's there. But surely spring break is going to get the best of her. And once all the girls are together, it's pretty much just instantly ridiculous and they're overtly sexual with each other. But with the direction and the music, this is only shown as discomforting. This is when the movie really begins to show itself and show what it really is, and it's definitely not sexy. One of the first scenes during the actual spring break, after the girls rob a bank to afford it, of course, is of Selena Gomez on the phone with her grandma, explaining her newfound paradise while showing all the drinking and sexual behavior happening behind it. And it's brilliant. It's showing this culture, which is often seen as just utterly depraved, but it really is just a positive experience for these people. They're having so much fun, and this is really their church. They're in paradise right now, and it's playing this fine line between the juxtaposition of what we're seeing and what they're saying into like a form of comedy, but it also ends up being this empathetic view of the society. And then, no, this all seems so toxic now because girls are pouring alcohol on drunk girls' bodies and Selena Gomez is lying to her mom, and then they're dancing and singing Britney Spears, and maybe they're just drunk girls who are having some fun. That's all right. Oh, but then we're reminded that they rob a bank and they're so crazy. And we keep getting lines like, this is where we're supposed to be. This is where we were supposed to find ourselves. And it just becomes this like existential experience that they're looking for here. And then they end up getting arrested. And then we're introduced to James Franco's Alien Al. And he is just the epitome of the evil spring break. To some of the girls, he seems like an angel, and then is just a demon to the others. And this is all so surreal and absolutely over the top. And as we're being put into Al's sort of life, and suddenly Selena Gomez's character turns into a real person It has a breakdown because this is all so surreal and insane. And then it just becomes terrifying. You imagine yourself as her. She seems like a real person. What would you do in this situation? It is so scary and it's so anxiety provoking. And there's a line when Selena Gomez is leaving and Vanessa Hudgens says, "Don't leave us." And this is the first time in the movie that the actual writing was super impactful and clever, because before it was just sort of these tropes they were saying. Just everything was just sort of obvious and a bit of an ironic tone to it. But this line, "Don't leave us," can be read differently from both sides. Vanessa Hudgens implies that Selena is leaving them as in leaving spring break, leaving all this fun they're gonna have. But Selena Gomez knows that she is leaving them. She's leaving them in this dangerous position. She knows better, and they don't, and there's nothing she can do about it. So she just has to effectively protect herself. And then we get one of the best monologues ever recorded from James Franco. It's so absurd as he is showing off his guns and his machetes along his wall of snapbacks and his shorts of every color as if they're equivalent. And it's this absurd and ridiculous depiction of this American dream that they have there. And then we're introduced to the antagonist, played effortlessly by Gucci Mane. And even though most of these characters could sort of be the antagonist, it's Gucci Mane who is shown as their opponent. And we're given some of the best self-reflexivity ever when Gucci Mane says his real-life catchphrase, "Burr," after committing a drive-by, and it's so funny. And then we're taken deeper into Alien's crazy surreal world. The other girls decide that they're going to become full spring breakers now. They're not going home. And it is about now that I remember that Selena Gomez's character hasn't been in the movie since. She just falls out completely halfway through after being treated as the main character. She is no longer a spring breaker and is no longer welcome in this movie. So the movie keeps up this dark view of the life these girls have gotten into, but it's also just shown as this, it didn't become a spiral down. This is sort of the life that they wanted when they had left home. You have to remind yourself that they had already robbed a bank in their hometown. They're not good girls gone bad. They were bad girls who went to a place they could be worse. And there's so much more to say about this movie, honestly. I think I could talk for about 5 minutes about one scene where James Franco tells the girls that they're his soulmates just because they're so messed up in the same way he is, or just about the beautiful classical arrangement of the Skrillex song that was included in the film's introduction. But honestly, the filmmaking is so good. The atmosphere that Corrine and his crew have created is so impressive and so effectively catches the right tones throughout everything. And everything from the costume design to the music to the cinematography just fits so well, but is also in constant juxtaposition to what is actually being shown or what is actually trying to be said. And I will say that some of the scenes end up feeling a bit redundant, maybe unnecessary. And it's like almost like they're shooting for the same messages that had already been explored earlier in the movie, which doesn't end up adding too much. But besides that, honestly, I don't have much bad to say. The main critiques of this movie, I think, are how sexualized everything is. And they aren't wrong, but it's not really endorsing anything that's happening there. Everything is shown as toxic and negative. But it's also shown as a weird form of liberation for these girls. As I've said multiple times, this is what Corrine is best at. He takes this moral depravity and he shows it in such a liberating and empathetic way. He's not validating them, but he's just showing these other ways of living, how it appeals to people and why they're doing it. And after watching it, I rewatched the trailer for this movie and it shows nearly every main plot point from the movie. And it's just so tonally different than it's shown. Because without the effects, the atmosphere, it feels totally different. It's just crazy. And this whole review, this whole thing, wasn't without a purpose. Wow, shocker, I know. But the purpose is the beach bum. which is Harmony Korine's next movie, coming out in March. And it's starring Matthew McConaughey as Moondog, appearing with Snoop Dogg, Zac Efron, Jonah Hill, Jimmy Buffett, Martin Lawrence, and Isla Fisher. And yeah, I know, there's a lot to unpack there. And from the trailer, it seems to be more of a comedy than Green's done before. But hopefully he's going to be going in for the advertising round in a similar way that Spring Deep Breakers did, that it was sort of shown as a more commercial thing. And then once it comes out, we're going to see what tricks Harmony has up his sleeves. And hopefully he still does and can take this movie in ways we would never expect. And the next song that I'm going to play is that Florence and the Machine song I mentioned earlier. This is Moderation.
Tell me to love you in moderation. Do I look moderate to you? Sip it slowly and pay attention. I just have to see it through.
So now I'm going to tell a story about a guy named Ned. Ned was a country kid. He grew up as a relatively reckless youth, rode around on dirt bikes with his friends, tipped cows, you know, Nicky Nicky Nine doored, he tipped goats, he egged kids, he tipped ducks, just, you know, getting into trouble. And what did you expect from an old country boy? Once Ned got older, he could tell that he was a bit different from the other kids. As some of them went to school, got their eyes set on their careers, their ambitions, Ned kept on his way of life. This was all he knew. He lived for the excitement and the constant thrill of how his life was going and was in no place to give it up. Ned began entering into derbies, competitions, and whatnot, slowly began to make a name for himself. Ned has shown over and over again that he was able to keep getting up every time he fell. Nothing could stop him. It was rumored once that at a derby in Nashville, Ned broke three fingers and received test results from his doctor, finding him positive for malaria in the middle of a run, still finished in the top three. And this is how Ned began to get attention. He was soon contacted by a film studio to be a stunt double in the pictures. Ned knew this is how he wanted his life to go. It was finally turning out for him. He began small in the business of show, nothing too crazy, as he hadn't met the certification yet to do the real stunts. Some of his first works were in Forrest Gump as a running double, and actually administered Uma Thurman's adrenaline shot in Pulp Fiction, which he had claimed to be his finest work. After a few years of minor experience, Ned had finally received his real stunt guy certification and started to get real action roles, playing stunt doubles for the film's biggest stars. Ned started to realize that the industry may not have been everything he had made it out to be. There was more politics, drama, even betrayals than he ever expected. At first, he was okay with this, complacent even, but after a few years in the industry, he couldn't stand it. He had no idea who to trust and where people's interests really were. During his work on the first Fast and Furious movie, this was when it really hit the peak for Ned. He had heard Paul Walker, rest in peace, mention how he thought that Ned was one of the best stuntmen he'd ever worked with. And then Michelle Rodriguez had mentioned how they were planning on getting rid of Ned as he had refused to get rid of his soul patch to match Paul's bare face. Ned knew this was a lie. Him and Paul had many intimate discussions about the facial hair for the duo, and after a careful reconciliation, they had agreed to just leaving the soul patch. No one from the production company had interacted with Ned about this, and they were planning on getting rid of him for it. This was unacceptable. Ned was needed on set, so he needed to get out of there, get it out of his head. It was a scene involving a 180-degree drift, something Ned was comfortable with. Ned approached the maneuver as he had done many times before until the eyes of his producer caught his eye, looking skeptically at the scene. Ned couldn't stand it. He felt a soul patch and knew that this couldn't keep going, but it was too late. Ned hadn't realized where his car was in the turn and still had his hand on his patch. He lost control and rolled the car over right into a pillar, and his vision immediately went blank. Ned woke up in a hospital bed and had no idea how long he was out or how injured he really was. It wasn't long until a doctor came to his bed and told him that he had broken both of his legs and it was recommended that he shouldn't be doing any stunts for 2 years. Ned was torn. This was his life, his career, and it was just getting started. If he wasn't able to ride or perform his art, he had no idea how he'd stay alive. After 3 insufferable days, Ned was moved into a more relaxed room at the hospital where he had a roommate and, more importantly, a television. Surprisingly, Ned hadn't been much of a fan of TV throughout his life. His life was so exciting that he never thought it'd be worthwhile for him. The only channel that they had in their room was ABC, and Ned couldn't tell that his roommate Tony had been invested in some of the shows. As much as he was happy there was something to watch, nothing really captivated him. This was when he noticed that there was something actually missing in his life. A different type of hospital. The General Hospital. The popular soap operas had revealed itself to Ned, and Tony was to be his gatekeeper. He had been watching the show for years. Every day, the show offered excitement, drama, and thrills to Ned. This became the high point of his day. He was happy for a change. He knew it was cheap entertainment while he was stuck in bed, but it satisfied him. Ned began to realize that maybe this was more than the show. It was definitely more to his roommate, Ned. There had been over 10,000 episodes of General Hospital at that point, and there has been over 4,000 episodes since. And Ned didn't take this lightly. God knows that he had less than 10,000 memories inside him. When Ned was able to leave the hospital, he continued his healing at home. He expected to leave the rat race of General Hospital behind. It was just a thing for him to do with his roommate, just another element of their friendship. He tried to find other ways to entertain himself, maybe watching some old tapes, some movies he had done, but nothing seemed to satisfy him. He got sick of being stuck in his house. He needed excitement. He needed a way to live the way that he used to live. Ned knew that there was no chance of getting out of the house, so he pondered his possibilities. He never experimented drugs before, but why start now? As soon as he dialed up that 1-800 number for the local dealer, a program came on the TV. It was General Hospital. As soon as the intro sequence began, Ned was in a daze. He didn't need drugs. This was the high for him. It wasn't Tony that Ned had missed from the hospital. It was the show. Tony was actually sort of a freak. But it was the show that had replaced everything that he used to love from the work. Ned hadn't even realized, but he missed parts about the business that he used to hate, the drama, the politics. But he loved it in General Hospital. Ned had started to receive the soap opera digest in the mail. He didn't even remember ordering it, but it might have been in one of his hospital stupors. It got to the point where the show was all Ned cared about. He had rarely contacted any friends or family since he got back home, and it didn't bother him at all. Ned began to obsess over the show. There were 10,000 episodes of the most important thing to him out there in the world, and he had no way of accessing them. All he knew about the show, about the old episodes, was what Tony had briefly mentioned to him and what he's read in the digest. Ned quickly deemed Tony's information unreliable, and 1 hour a day of General Hospital just wasn't meeting his requirements. Ned had seeked out a seller from the local classifieds who said he could get his hands on a VHS copy of nearly every episode. Ned knew that it was his best shot, but he didn't have nearly enough storage for the 4,000 VHS tapes. Ned had remembered that one of his old friends had mentioned that the seniors' home that their mom were in played soap operas all the time, and that the seniors' home and they were playing soap operas all the time. Ned called around to the local homes and found that one of them was playing old reruns of General Hospital nearly all the waking hours, except for when the new episodes were on or Larry King. But the home seemed confused, but they allowed Ned to stop by and hang out every once in a while. It was of no cost to them. Their home was only a 30-minute trip in his wheelchair, and he was more than willing to make the trip. The old episodes were much better than he'd ever expected. He was seeing the evolution of the show. It was magical. Like seeing something grow up, like watching a life, or lives even, unfold in front of you. Ned began to quickly accept that the show was worth more than the 30-minute trip. Ned had offered to pay the going rate for a bed and began to live in the home. He had begun to become friends with the other occupants, and because they had the same interests that he did, the soap operas and his dangerous stunts. He entertained them with his stories, and they offered in-depth and analytical recaps of the old episodes and plot lines. Ned knew this was his paradise. He told the stories of his past as if those times were far gone. He had no plans of returning to the business of show. He had no plans of returning to the life outside of the hospital. He was finally satisfied. A few months later, the old folks' home received a call from a film producer saying they had tracked down Ned, and since his injury, he was probably recovered by that point and ready to go back to work. They had missed him back at work. But then, a nurse went to check on Ned in his room. He wasn't moving. He had no pulse. He had passed on. An autopsy had determined that Ned had died from natural causes. Despite his age of 30, Ned's body had aged to be 95 years old. The other patients said that Ned had lived through many lives. The show had given him the ability to experience more life than any normal being. No one was sad, as they knew that Ned had fulfilled his purpose. And with that, we will be ending this week's show. As always, thanks to anyone who is currently listening, and please remember that ignorance of your culture is not considered cool. And this is Bjork with Triumph of a Heart.